I bring you greetings again in the name of Jesus, and it's just a privilege to be here again. I want to thank you as a congregation for putting up with us, allowing us to be here among you, renew some old acquaintances. It truly has been a blessing to me to be here among you, to see your passion and your zeal, your love for the Lord, find other people that are serving Him with all their hearts. That warms my heart and gives me courage. Keep serving God. Our theme this weekend was on exercise. And I don't know how many of you are here that weren't here Saturday night. But maybe we'll just read our theme verse again from 1 Timothy chapter 4 and just talk about this poster just for a minute or two. 1 Timothy chapter 4. Let's read verse 6, 7, 8, and 8. If thou put the brethren in remembrance of these things, thou shalt be a good minister of Jesus Christ. This is Paul telling young Timothy, remember these things. He was talking about apostasy, hypocrisy, and asceticism, if you remember. And he says, if you keep the brethren remembering these things, thou shalt be a good minister of Jesus Christ, nourished up in the words of faith and of good doctrine, whereunto thou hast attained, but refuse profane and old wives' fables, and exercise thyself rather unto godliness. For bodily exercise profiteth little. There is a moment of profit, a bit of profit in bodily exercise. But godliness is profitable unto all things, having promise of the life that now is, and of that which is to come. Do you want a promise that's just for today, or do you want a promise that's for eternity? We want a promise for eternity, and so we want to exercise more than bodily exercise, exercise godliness. Now, we talked about how godliness is kind of made up of these three parts in our lives: the foundation of what we believe, the conviction that we have in our minds. We sang tonight, Hold to God's Unchanging Hand. Do you believe that? Is that a conviction in your life? Is that something that roots and grounds you? If it is, then that's going to affect your passions. It's going to affect how you serve Him and what you do, which results in fruit, which is godliness. Godliness is the fruit, not the root, we said. We could think of it in a lot of different ways. Tonight our subject is on spiritual appetite, exercising our spiritual appetite. At work, one of the men in the office has sitting on the corner of his desk a little round globe, and it is an automatic M&M dispenser. Can you imagine? You put your hand underneath and it's even motion activated, and as long as your hand's there, it'll spit out M&Ms for you. That's even better than Edwin's Smarties, isn't it? But suppose I knew that somewhere inside that globe was a poisonous M&M with enough venom to make you sick and die. What would you do? Would you still have an appetite? Would you still have a longing to just, you know, there's 2,000 M&Ms in there. It's only a 1 in 2,000 chance that I'll hit it, unless if I eat more than one. You see, if I really believe that M&M will kill me, I think I'll be pretty passionate about staying away from that, right? It's going to result in conduct that says, you know what? No way. I'm not going to do that. Because it's something that I believe. It's something that I care about. Something that's a conviction to me. Jesus said in Matthew chapter 5, verse 6, blessed are they that hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled. Blessed are they, happy, rewarded, fulfilled, are the people who know what it means to feast on the righteousness of God. Now, thinking about the illustration of a tree, we could actually just use these Beatitudes right here for our sermon tonight, though I didn't decide to do that. But think about it with me. As you have this concept of a tree, I think that verse 6 is the middle connecting part. It's the emotion, it's the feeling, it's the desire that is within the heart of a person who desires godliness. What is the root? Look at the first Beatitudes. In order for you, just as a foundation to this thought, these thoughts on a spiritual appetite, if you're going to have a hunger and a thirst for righteousness, you need to be poor in spirit. You need to have a broken heart. You need to be a person that mourns, that sees your own sin and your own imperfection, and you weep before God about your needs. And you also will be a person who is meek. That is the foundation of a heart that is ready to reach out to God with an appetite for righteousness. And then, what is the fruit? So if the root is a heart of meekness and humility and brokenness, the emotion or the conviction or the passion is a hunger for God. The fruit is mercy and purity and peacemakers. And even persecution is a fruit of godliness. Now, Jesus cares about our spiritual appetite. We see that here from these verses. And he promises happiness and contentment if we crave the right things. I just want to ask a few questions to get our minds thinking about what is spiritual appetite and what does it mean. Do you have an appetite? Do you have a spiritual appetite? What is your spiritual appetite? What is mine? Does everyone have a spiritual appetite? How do you get one? And how does it contribute to spiritual Christian experience or Christian victory? Is there a connection there? Can our appetite be developed or trained or changed? Does it even matter what kind of appetite I develop? If I'm able to develop it, does it matter what I develop it into? Does it matter if I crave earthly pursuits? Does it matter if I find satisfaction in succeeding here in this earth? Or maybe most importantly, can I crave earthly things? Can I crave tangible earthly things and still find my satisfaction in God? It's a question that we need to answer tonight. Can I do both? Can you do both? Turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 3. I want to look at a little scolding, perhaps, that Paul gave to the church at Corinth. He seemed to be a bit frustrated with their lack of spiritual appetite. Did I say second? Confusing myself. 1 Corinthians chapter 2 and chapter 3. Paul here was dealing with some weak believers, and he was chiding them for their carnality and their immaturity in regards to their spiritual appetite. Let's read a few of these verses. Going to be referring to verses from chapter 2 and 3, but for sake of time, we'll just jump in and read a few of them. Let's start at verse 1 of chapter 3. And I, brethren, could not speak unto you as unto spiritual, but as unto carnal, even unto babes in Christ. I have fed you with milk and not with meat, for hitherto ye were not able to bear it, neither yet now are ye able. For ye are yet carnal, for whereas there is among you envying and strife and divisions, are ye not carnal and walk as men? For while one saith, I am of Paul, and another, I am of Apollos, are ye not carnal? Who then is Paul, and who is Apollos? But ministers by whom ye believed, even as the Lord gave to every man I have planted, Apollos watered, but God gave the increase. So then neither is he that planteth anything, neither he that watereth, but God that giveth the increase. Now he that planteth and he that watereth are one, and every man shall receive his own reward according to his own labor. For we are laborers together with God. Ye are God's husbandry. Ye are God's building. According to the grace of God which is given unto me as a wise master builder, I have laid the foundation, and another buildeth thereon. But let every man take heed how he buildeth thereon. For other foundation can no man lay than that is laid, which is Jesus Christ. And then let's jump down to verse 21. Therefore, let no man glory in men, for all things are yours, whether Paul or Apollos or Cephas or the world or life or death or things present or things to come, all are yours, and ye are Christ's, and Christ is God's. I want to look at five thoughts in relation to a healthy spiritual appetite. If you're taking notes, you may want to just put a healthy spiritual appetite, dot, dot, dot. Each of them are going to start with that, and it'll save you just a little bit of writing. First one, as I try to understand what Paul is telling these brothers and sisters who are he's calling weak and carnal, the first thing is a healthy spiritual appetite is founded in the belief of divine ownership. A healthy spiritual appetite is founded in the belief of divine ownership. If we back up to, verse 9, we read verse 9. He says that we're laborers together with God. We are part of God's husbandry. We're part of God's building. In verse 16, know ye not that ye are the temple of God, and that the Spirit of God dwelleth in you? And then in verse 23, ye are Christ's, and Christ is God's. As we try to understand what it means to have a spiritual appetite and evaluate our spiritual appetite, one of the founding roots, one of the founding principles that must be clear in our minds is that we are God's. We are God's. We belong to God. He owns me because of creation, first of all, and then he bought me back. If I've been born again, if you've been born again, you're his twice. He bought you. He made you, and then he bought you back because you turned away from him, because I turned away from him. And now as a person that's created in God's image for his glory and for his purposes, does it matter what we feed on? Does it matter what catches our attention? Does it matter what we crave? Absolutely it matters, because we're God's. And so God has given us direction. The psalmist says, O God, thou art my God. Thou art my God. You see, possession. God is my God. Early will I seek thee. Because he owns you, he has every right to care about your pursuits, your dreams, your desires, and your appetites. Later on in the book, this same book, in chapter 6 of 1 Corinthians, Paul says, for ye are bought with a price. What was that price? What did God pay to buy you and to make you his own? Did it cost him a lot? Sure did. It cost him his own dear son. We just went through communion. I don't know if you had communion here or not. But as I thought again about that bitter agony that Christ went through in the garden, and as I thought about God the Father seeing his son hanging there on the cross, it must have been heart-wrenching. But he did it. Therefore, glorify God in your body and in your spirit and in your appetites, if I can add that, which are God's. Now, how do I glorify God in my spirit? We want to look at that in some of the remaining points. But there's a quote from C.S. Lewis I want to share with you. C.S. Lewis says, you don't have a soul. Now, maybe I have your attention. Let me say it again. You don't have a soul. You are a soul. You have a body. Think about that in relation to divine ownership. It's just a play on words, I suppose. But ultimately, we are a soul that's been created to live eternally with God. And God gave us a body for a few years to house that soul inside. But you're God's. You have a living soul inside you that God has put there, and He wants a relationship with you. That is the real you. I am the soul. I am a soul that God made. And God cares about our appetites. We need to understand that God owns us. It's going to be very foundational in the things that we pursue and the things that we do with our life and the godly fruit that we endeavor to display in our lives. Psalm 42, verses 1 and 2, "As the hart panteth after the water brooks, so panteth my soul after thee, O God. My soul thirsteth for God, for the living God. When shall I come and appear before God?" This is the heart cry of a man who understood that God owned his soul, and his soul was crying out in thirst, just as a hart or a deer pants for the water brooks. God wants to see that in our life because we are His. Secondly, a healthy spiritual appetite is shaped by denying our carnal, worldly, and fleshly appetites. A healthy spiritual appetite is shaped by denying our carnal, worldly, and fleshly appetites. Here in the first four verses of chapter 3, he says that their problem was that they were carnal. He says, "You're carnal. There's envying and strife and divisions among you. Are ye not carnal?" He says, "Can't you see this? There's carnality, there's worldliness, there's something in your hearts that's keeping you from desiring God like you should." Now, what was the strife over? What was the divisions over? Well, they were arguing about whose side they were on, who they were baptized with, or who was the evangelist when they responded. "I'm Paul's." "No, I'm Apollos's." And it sounds kind of foolish to us. But I think what happens when our spiritual appetite is not what it should be, and the things that we feast on are worldly pursuits, then that's what's going to come out of a life like that. Let me explain it this way. Let's just suppose that 2/3 of you here were farmers. That's probably not the case anymore. But suppose 2/3 of you were farmers, and at the fellowship meal today, the conversation would have consisted of herd genetics and the newest technology in milking parlors and I don't know. I would be lost because I don't know anything about that. But if that's all that you would feast on through the week, if your life was wrapped up in having the latest and greatest, that's what you talk about. Is that what we talk about? Or suppose 2/3 of you were printers. Now, I could talk about that. But it would leave other people out. And what happens is when that is the basis of our friendships and our conversations, that's when cliques form. That's when these partyisms, if you want to call it, these groups within a group form, and it creates strife. Because, well, look at it the other way. Let's suppose that we all rallied around this word. Let's suppose we all rallied around living lives that are fruitful with godliness. And we communicate on that level, and we communicate our struggles and our fears and our victories. Suddenly it breaks down those cliques, because we all can rally around that interest. Jesus said something interesting to Peter in Matthew 16. Maybe we should just turn there. I want to read a couple of verses. It says that Jesus started to talk about his suffering. He tried to prepare his disciples for what was coming. And Peter took him aside and was rebuking him. But look at verse 23. Jesus said to Peter, "Get," this is Matthew 16, verse 23, "Get thee behind me, Satan. Thou art an offense unto me, for thou savorest," think about appetite, "thou savorest not the things that be of God, but those that be of men." And he goes right on to say, "If any man will come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross." That's part. If you're going to develop a healthy spiritual appetite, you have to learn what it means to deny yourself of earthly pursuits, or at least the love of earthly pursuits. We do live here and we have jobs, but that can't be the focus of what we feed on and what our lives revolve around. Because Jesus would say to us, "Thou savorest not the things which be of God." 1 John makes it so clear in 1 John 2, verse 15 and 16, "Love not the world, neither the things that are in the world. If any man love the world, the love of the Father is not in him." Love, speaking of appetite and desire and passion, if we have a passion for the things of the world, then we cannot. You want to answer that question I answered in the beginning? You cannot have a passion for the things of the world and a passion for God. You cannot. "For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh and the lust of the eyes and the pride of life is not of the Father, but is of the world." Thirdly, a healthy spiritual appetite motivates one to support a body of believers. I don't plan to spend a lot of time on this, but as I evaluated what Paul was trying to encourage them in, and the argument that he used for chiding them for their weakness, he said, "I can only feed you milk. I want to feed you meat because you're part of God's workmanship. You're part of a greater body." We talked about that this morning, or maybe it was Saturday night. We talked about being a part of something greater than that. Look at verse 9, verse 10, and 11. He calls God the master builder, and Paul talks about laying the foundation. Even though, if you look back in chapter 2, he says he came to them, chapter 2, verse 2, "For I determined not to know anything among you save Jesus Christ and him crucified." He came to them with a very central message of Jesus, and yet, at the same time, he was setting up churches. He was ordaining elders. He was helping people to find a place inside a brotherhood because we are part of God's building, and part of that is identifying with a local brotherhood as well. Now, this is maybe more of an evaluation to help us understand where our spiritual appetite is or not. How do you feel about being a part of a local congregation? How do you feel about the input that the brotherhood has in your life? You see, there's a big individualistic message that's going forth in a lot of churches today and a lot of so-called Christians. I don't need the structure of church. I don't need rules and guidelines and regulations and standards. I can follow Jesus more closely if it's just me and Jesus. But Paul didn't teach that. He taught churches and brotherhoods because there is, well, I thought about it again with communion. We were just through communion, and you think about how do you have communion? That's a command in Scripture. How do you have communion without a brotherhood? But also, it just reaffirms the beauty of being one with each other. We share the same bread. We share the same cup. And we share salvation through Jesus' blood. There's a oneness and a fellowship there that is so rich and fulfilling. But I want to ask myself the question and you the question. How do I find myself responding to that? Do I find myself with the desire to just pour out my life for this brotherhood? This congregation here at Calvary, those of you who are members here, do you have a yearning and a desire to be a part and make a difference in this church? If not, Evaluate your appetite. Are you willing to give up your personal agenda? Are you willing to take the time to rejoice and weep with your brother? Are you willing to help a brother in need? Are you willing to support the functions of the church? That grows out of a good, healthy spiritual appetite. We have a couple attending our church. They are not members. They're still observing. And we had a number of families move recently, just a few miles down the road. And Jim told me after one of the moves, he said, "You have no idea what you have here." He said, "To have a whole church show up on a Thursday evening and move a whole family's household in 2 hours, it doesn't happen in any other church," he said. Well, that was his short vision, I guess, but they didn't find that concept of brotherhood. He said, "I just want you to know that you have something very special that we haven't seen in any other church that we've been a part of. Do you value that? Do you treasure that? I want to encourage you to be a part of that." Not only does it contribute to a good, healthy spiritual appetite, but it also is an outgrowth of a good appetite. Fourthly, a healthy spiritual appetite is a result of cultivating a proper diet. It's a result of cultivating a proper diet. Paul talks about some deep things, especially in chapter 2. He talks about the wisdom of God in a mystery in verse 7. Even the hidden wisdom which God ordained before the world unto our glory. He talks in verse 10 that God reveals things to us by His Spirit, and the Spirit searcheth all things, yea, the deep things of God. Verse 13, he talks about comparing spiritual things with spiritual things at the end of the verse. These are things that thinking deep is something that needs to be cultivated. It's not something that just is natural to us. And we shrink at that, or at least I do. Not all of you are preachers, but most of you at least have devotions sometimes. And wouldn't it just be really nice to just pull a set of outlines somewhere from the internet or whatever, and I got a sermon all ready to go. That ease, or the easiness of study, or the escaping from the pain of difficult, long, laboring study appeals to the flesh. But Paul was teaching them that there's something that you need to cultivate as part of a spiritual, healthy appetite. You see, regular diet shapes our appetite over time. You'll want more of whatever you feed on. I want you to think about that. As you think about what you feed on, I want to get very practical here. What do you read in a day's time? Where do you go to for information? Where do you go to for inspiration? Where do you go for challenge? Where do you go for just extra time that you have? Do you go read the news? What do you read? You see, there is a direct connection that we can't get away from. What we feed on is what we are, what we become. You think about food. If you eat a very unhealthy diet, it's going to affect who you are. You feed a church entertainment, like we see in many modern-day Christian churches today, you end up with a whole church full of people who are entertainment crazed. They're addicted. The only way they can worship is with a big splash, because they were taught that. They were fed that, and it grew on them. You feed a church rule after rule without any principle, godly principle, biblical application, you'll create a church that is very works-oriented on a more personal level. It's easy to see that out there, right? If you feed on the praise of men, what will you become? Our thoughts and our life will be consumed with that pursuit. Everything I do will be evaluated instead of in the light of What's the foundation? What's the principle? What's the root? I'll say, what will people think of me? And an unhealthy craving for the praise of men will just drive you deeper into that, and you'll find yourself in a position where sometimes somebody's going to criticize you, and you're not going to please everybody. And then what do? Because you don't have a foundation. Personal illustration. I had a conversation with somebody, and they meant it totally good. They didn't say anything wrong. But they asked me a question, and I wanted a different answer to that question than what I could give them. I wanted to be able to totally reassure them that nothing was wrong. And that thing ate away at me because I kept thinking, what are they thinking of me? I was studying. I was trying to pray, and I kept finding that thing coming back to me. And I said, Lord, am I living for the praise of men? It is so easy to just base our lives off of that. What about if we feed on the latest interior decorating ideas on Pinterest? Your home will probably show. What if you feed on the Auto Trend magazine day after day? Or you feed on romance novels? Or you feed on music, country music, ungodly music, music that you listen to on the sly? It's going to leave a profound influence on your character and who you are. What you feed on is what you become. This is why I'm so concerned with how much posting of pictures goes on and in WhatsApp status. Because not only does it show what we're feeding on, but we also are responsible for our brother, and we're putting things in front of them that's not what they're feeding on if they're following your status. When we put on things that the world idolizes, like big trucks and manicured lawns, even our vacations, our hunting, and our expensive toys, does it matter? Does it matter? Are we responsible for what we feed to our brothers and sisters? Diet shapes our appetite. Your appetite will grow into what you feed on. It does. It changes. I think about, as a boy, I could not stand cauliflower and broccoli cooked. The smell was nauseating when Mom would cook it. I couldn't stand it. But you know what? As I matured a little bit and as I got brave enough to try it, my appetite actually changed, and I can totally enjoy that. You can change your appetites in a physical way. I think about some of our Mennonite cooking. Those pies at the back were so good today. We're kind of, as Mennonites, we've kind of developed a little bit of a reputation for these rich sweets, rich desserts, right? We've developed a bit of a taste for it, and sometimes it shows. But I work with a man, not Mennonite background, and occasionally we'll bring snacks into work, and he'll just shake his head. He said, how can you eat things that are that sweet? He said, it just turns his stomach. He's not used to it. We do, and I know there's a variation among us too. That's a general statement, but our diet does shape our appetite, and so I just want to challenge all of us, choose your diet carefully. Choose your diet carefully. What appetites are shaping your life? What are shaping my life? We need to cultivate a proper diet. How regular is your time with the Lord? Is it something that you miss pretty frequently if you just wake up a little too late, or you have a fussy child that morning? And it's just something that gets brushed off. I guess I'll have to read a little extra tomorrow. We need to cultivate a proper diet, and daily reading of the Word is a huge, huge part of that. What books are laying on your nightstand? I think it's good to have good reading material laying there. Grab that instead of your phone. I know we maybe knock technology a lot, but technology also has come with a lot of opportunities There's a lot of apps for just a thought of the day, a verse of the day, a quote. There's so many sermons that you can fill your day with if you have a job that accommodates that. Listen, fill your life with that kind of thing. 1 Timothy 4 says, give attendance to reading. It's an important part of cultivating a proper diet. That intake will make a difference in who you are. And number 5, a properly developed spiritual appetite will find satisfaction. Jesus said in Matthew 6, blessed are they that hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled. Paul also said here in 1 Corinthians that he had meat to feed them. He had things that would have been good for them to take, but they couldn't handle it. They weren't ready for it. Also, verses 12 to 15 are kind of interesting, and I don't even profess to be able to explain exactly what all this means. But as Paul writes about our lives and our work being tried, especially as we come to the end of our life, and we think about what we did with our life, what we fed on, and what the fruit of that was, what is it going to be? Is it going to be something that is satisfying, that is worthwhile, something that's still left? Or is it going to all be burned up? People are looking for satisfaction. And they look a lot of different places. But whatever you think will bring satisfaction is what you're going to pursue. Whatever you think will bring satisfaction is what you're going to pursue in your life. It will be the consuming passion of your life. And it's so sad to see people passionate about things that are so worldly. I met our mailman one day at Walmart. He was off the job, but we got to talking. And he said, you know, I don't spend any of my money on me. He says, I buy a few little things at Walmart. But he said, every speck of overtime just goes into my retirement fund. And every check goes, all that I can, I just stash it away. He said, I just can't wait. He's just driven for that day when he can retire and have a big chunk sitting there. It's a passion of his life. He thinks that will be satisfying to come to his 60s or 70s and say, now I can sit back and relax. He's throwing a lot of things away in the meantime. There are people that are passionate about being debt-free, and that drives them. It becomes a consuming passion because they think that would bring the most satisfaction. And I don't want to knock that. I think it's good if we can be. But don't let that become the passion of your life. There's a lot of people that think that sexual gratification will bring them satisfaction. And they turn to pornography or worse. And they, young people especially, that doesn't satisfy. Don't make that a part of your appetite. What does bring satisfaction? Well, Isaiah 55, let's read a few verses there, and we'll try to close this in a few minutes. Ho, everyone that thirsteth, come ye to the waters, and he that hath no money, come ye, buy and eat. Yea, come, buy wine and milk without money and without price. Wherefore do you spend money for that which is not bread, and your labor for that which satisfieth not? Is there things that you're spending money on that doesn't satisfy? Is there things in your life that you're laboring for that bring no satisfaction? What's the foundation? What does God's word say brings satisfaction? Hearken diligently unto me, and eat ye that which is good, and let your soul delight itself in fatness. Incline your ear and come unto me. Hear, and your soul shall live, and I will make an everlasting covenant with you, even the sure mercies of David. We could keep on reading. But it talks about seeking the Lord while he can be found later on. Forsaking our wicked ways, turning to God, and finding his pardon. That is what satisfies. That is what brings rest and refreshment to an appetite that's hungering and thirsting after righteousness. Jesus said that we will be filled, we will be satisfied. You pursue the wrong things and you'll never be satisfied. You can be a church member but have little time for God and be lost because you're not seeking things of God. You don't have an appetite for the things of God. But if you pursue righteousness and the righteousness that comes from God through Christ, pursue holiness, that will bring you satisfaction now and it climaxes into eternity. A.W. Tozer says, "To have found God and still pursue him is the soul's paradox of love." You know, that is a strange paradox. To have found God and keep pursuing him is the soul's paradox of love. You see, when you find God and you find God for who he really is in your life, there is a satisfaction and a desire that just makes you long for more and makes you want to know him more and makes you want to feast on his word. And that's a strange paradox. God says you'll be satisfied. Jesus said you'll find satisfaction and yet you'll still want more. It's beautiful. Well, Jesus is that bread of life. Jesus is that living water. Jesus is the one that you need, a relationship with him. And if you don't have that tonight, I beg you to make him your Lord and Master. James says that one of the things for health, our diet does contribute to our health. There's no doubt about that. But he says, James says, if you want to be healed, one of the things that you need to do, one of the spiritual fruits, the spiritual exercises, is confession. And so I just challenge you tonight, if your spiritual appetite is not what it is, if you're feasting on YouTube videos and that has become a passion, you're addicted to that, or you're feasting on the music of the world, or you're feasting on lust, confess it and find healing and change your diet so that your appetite can change. The psalmist said, "One thing have I desired of the Lord." What was his appetite? What was his passion? What was his desire? "That will I seek after, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to behold the beauty of the Lord and to inquire in his tabernacle." May God find us as people who are seeking him every day of our life, filling our lives with the things that bring true peace and joy and satisfaction, feasting on the things that make us more like him, and daily crucifying the flesh and the works of darkness, and committing our lives daily to him. That's the kind of people he wants, and that's the kind of people that he can use. God bless you as a congregation. Exercise these things. It's difficult. It requires persistence. But keep on. There is a reward. Godliness profits a little bit today, but it profits for all eternity. And we want that. We want that profit. We want to enjoy eternity with God. Let's be faithful. God bless you.